Jesus has timed this perfectly. He's given Zacchaeus enough time to figure out he can't see through this crowd. In fact, this crowd isn't going to let him. They're probably stepping on his toes and elbowing him. Jesus knows how much time Zacchaeus needs to run ahead of the parade. Jesus knows which street is lined with sycamore trees that Zacchaeus will climb. A tree with foliage that Zacchaeus assumes is enough to hide him, but Jesus knows which tree it is, and he knows which limb it is.
While you probably know the Sunday school song about Zacchaeus the tax collector, chances are you may not understand the extent of his sin. The extent of his sin magnifies the miraculous nature of his restoration. Only Jesus can deliver the kind of life-transforming grace that would cause the richest cheat in Israel to become a compassionate, benevolent, above and beyond kind of follower of Christ. Welcome back to Wisdom for the Heart, the Bible teaching ministry of Stephen Davey. This message is called Snapshots of Ruin and Rescue.
So we're in Luke chapter 19 now for the first time, Luke 19. And I'd like to call this first snapshot a picture of luxury. Just the opening verse. He, Jesus, entered Jericho and was passing through. Now, if you were with us in our last study, Jesus is heading toward Jerusalem. In a matter of days, he will hang upon a cross. He's passing through Jericho, but it isn't a detour. It's deliberate. As one author put it, God never does anything in passing. He does everything on purpose. Well, Jesus arrives in what we've learned to be New Jericho, just a mile south of Old Jericho. This city, the New Jericho, was expanded and refurbished by King Herod. It was the perfect spot for his vacation palace. He wasn't the only one. Wealthy people built their vacation homes in Jericho. It was the perfect place, as it was an oasis in the land. The politically well-connected would come for retreats and vacations, conferences to Jericho. They would enjoy the marbled bathhouses and palace receptions with members of the royal family. The city had an elite, opulent population of entrepreneurs and tradesmen. It was nicknamed the Little Paradise in the first century. It became famous for its manicured landscapes, its rose gardens, which historians said would scent the air for miles around. It was also famous for growing and tending balsam trees. Balsam was a main export from Jericho. It was turned into lotions and cleansing agents. Even today, it's called an essential oil for stress relief. Well, back in Jesus' day, it was considered to have healing properties. History records for us that the streets of Jericho were lined with palm trees. In fact, another nickname for this city was the City of Palms. It was a city of millionaires, frankly. History also records for us that some of the streets in Jericho were lined with sycamore trees, a type of tree in this region that looked more like an oak tree with large leaves and thick, low limbs, perfect for climbing. Luke gives us another snapshot. We'll caption this one, A Picture of Misery. Now, it might not seem like it at first. We're going to take a closer look. Verse 2. And behold, there was a man named Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector, and he was rich. Now, the word for rich was used just a few paragraphs earlier for the nobleman. It was translated in chapter 18, extremely rich. This is an expression for someone who is incredibly rich. We might say today he was filthy rich, although there's nothing inherently filthy about being rich unless it's somebody else. But in Zacchaeus' case, it was dirty money. Now, let me give you a little more backstory to this snapshot. Jericho happened to be a major intersection for trade routes leading to other cities, even other countries, south to Egypt. Tariffs, tolls, customs on exports and imports literally brought cash flowing into Jericho and then into the coffers of the Roman Empire. Jericho was one of the three largest taxation centers in this part of the world. The Roman government, as you may know, sold the right of taxation in these Jewish territories to Jewish men who did the unthinkable. They collected taxes from Jewish people, which then in turn financed the Roman Empire, their oppressors. And because of that, Jewish people viewed tax collectors then as traitors and turncoats. In fact, during the days of Jesus, there were two categories of people most despised: lepers and tax collectors. They were barred from the synagogue. They were barred then from the center of social life. The synagogue represented the family, the extended family, marriages, festivals. So these people effectively said goodbye to extended family and friends and their own people and, frankly, to God. And they didn't care. They were considered perpetually unclean. They would have been avoided like the plague. They had everything, but they knew they really had nothing. This is a snapshot of misery. But it gets worse. Luke tells us here that Zacchaeus was a chief tax collector. Now, that term is used only by Luke. For those of you who are new to our study, you might not know that the Roman government gave tax collectors free rein. They could assess the value of goods moving through the region and then determine the tax. And an honest tax collector didn't automatically get rich. This was an honest job. In fact, over in Luke chapter 2, tax collectors came to John the Baptist to repent, and they said to John, "Now what do we do?" And John didn't say, "Quit your jobs." He said, "Stop overcharging." So you didn't automatically get rich. But a dishonest tax collector did. They inflated the value of the goods. They charged more than was due. They paid the government, the Roman government, their due, and then they lined their pockets with the rest. So Luke is not just tossing stray words around when he writes here that Zacchaeus was a chief tax collector and he was rich. That's another way of saying, and he was a criminal. He was crooked. He would be, we would view it as the godfather of a corrupt enterprise. He's sort of the CEO of Extortion Incorporated. He was calloused, shrewd, cold. He could look you in the eye and tell you how what the tax was. And he knew he was lying, and he knew you knew he was lying, but he didn't blink. We also know by this phrase that Zacchaeus would have been one of the three most hated Jewish men in Israel. There were only three chief tax collectors in the land. The other two lived in Capernaum and Caesarea. Tuck that away in your mind. All three men would have had dozens of busy subordinate tax collectors working for them, carrying out their unethical commands. Now, Zacchaeus was old enough at this point to have risen through the ranks. He has become one of only three men in the nation with this kind of power, which means for decades he had lived his life cheating one person after another, one business after another, one tradesman after another. And outside of royalty, he's one of the richest men in Jericho. So I say all of that to set the scene. This is not a snapshot of a satisfied man. By now, Zacchaeus was middle-aged, hardened by his crimes. He was empty. Now, to add to the irony here is the fact that Zacchaeus is a Jewish name derived from a Hebrew word that means innocent and pure. Zacchaeus knew that he was anything but innocent and pure, and he was probably old enough at this point to begin thinking about what would happen after he died. And the older you get, the more you think about that. That moment when you stand before God. What we do know is that he's desperate enough to throw caution to the wind and act entirely out of context according to this culture. He's about to run, which Middle Eastern men never did, and he's going to climb a tree, which they never did. But he's desperate. He's heard of this traveling rabbi. No doubt he has heard that this rabbi was actually known to be kind to tax collectors, to even eat meals with them. And that was stunning to him, perhaps even hopeful. It's possible that Zacchaeus had heard the news that Jesus had changed the life of perhaps one of Zacchaeus' former employees, a subordinate tax collector by the name of Matthew. We don't know, but what we do know is that God's Spirit is compelling him to run down this street, and he's going to chase him up a tree. Now, let's caption the next snapshot this way. It's a picture of curiosity. Now, verse 3. And he was seeking to see who Jesus was, but on account of the crowd, he could not, because he was small in stature. So he ran on ahead and climbed up into a sycamore tree to see him, for he was about to pass that way. I love the implication of all of the divine activity going on behind the scenes here. Think about it. Jesus has timed this perfectly. He's given Zacchaeus enough time to figure out he can't see through this crowd. In fact, this crowd isn't going to let him. They're probably stepping on his toes and elbowing him. Jesus knows how much time Zacchaeus needs to run ahead of the parade. Jesus knows which street is lined with sycamore trees that Zacchaeus will climb. Jesus knows how much time Zacchaeus needs to climb that tree, a tree with foliage that Zacchaeus assumes is, you know, enough to hide him, but Jesus knows which tree it is, and he knows which limb it is. Is he walking through Jericho and now down Sycamore Tree Lane? It is not accidental. It's intentional. Now, Luke shows us another snapshot. We'll call this one a picture of urgency. Verse 5, and when Jesus came to the place, he looked up and said to him, Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for I must stay at your house today. Note that. I'm coming now. I don't care if you haven't vacuumed the floor or cut the grass or whatever. I'm not. You notice Jesus isn't asking for an appointment. He's not talking about later on in the day or tomorrow. He's saying now. And by the way, if you didn't catch it, Zacchaeus, I know your name. And we've never been introduced. So get this immediacy, this urgency from the Lord in this text. Hurry, I must stay at your house today. The word for stay, by the way, isn't just stop over for a quick bite. It literally could be rendered to take up lodging. I'm gonna come over and I'm gonna spend a lot of time talking with you. Let's go. Verse 6, I love this. So he hurried down, he hurried and came down and received him joyfully. He's probably got splinters in his hands and leaves in his hair. He doesn't care. And his mind is probably racing as he, you know, comes down one limb at a time. This rabbi is the first rabbi who has not spit in my direction. And how in the world does he know my name? Jesus uses this encounter, by the way, as an illustration. Look over at verse 10. The Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost. You ought to underline that text. This is the theme verse of the Gospel of Luke. This is the purpose statement of the incarnation. Jesus is like a heat-seeking missile. He has left heaven, joined the human race. Why? To seek and to save the lost. The word for save could be translated rescued. The word for lost can be translated ruined. I love that paraphrase. He came to rescue ruined lives. But something's going on in the heart of Zacchaeus. Luke doesn't give us the details, but this encounter reveals that he's come to the point where he knows he's lost. He's missing something. His life is ruined. Look what he's done with it. Now, why doesn't Jesus save everybody in Jericho? Why only two men, at least those recorded for us, a blind beggar and a crooked tax collector? Well, I talk to people, I don't know about you, but I talk to them all the time, who are not saved because they don't want to be. Jesus doesn't need to rescue them. Their lives aren't ruined without him. They don't need to be found. They're not lost, and they're certainly not lost sinners. Who do you think you are to tell me that? Well, that's what's happening here. This is a picture of unrepentant, unredeemed humanity. Look at verse 7. It spells it out. And when they, that's that multitude of several thousand people, when they saw it, Jesus, go into this home. Note this. They all, to a person, grumbled. He has gone in to be the guest of a man, note this, who is a sinner. We're not that. That's not who we are. We're not like him. He's a sinner, and we are not. Now, granted, this development would have been a huge shock. One author put it into perspective when he wrote that this were happening a generation ago. This would be like Jesus staying in the home of Al Capone. This was beyond comprehension. So get this picture in your mind. You've got thousands of people now camped all around the opulent estate of the chief tax collector, the town's biggest crook. And just about everybody out there on his lawn has been ripped off by this man. And Jesus is giving him attention. But now get ready for an even bigger surprise. If you look between verse 7 and verse 8, as I've mentioned before, there's that little white space between those two verses. And you remember that between verses or even chapters, there can be days or weeks, sometimes in this case, several hours. So several hours later, Luke gives us a fifth snapshot. We'll call this a picture of sincerity. Verse 8, and Zacchaeus stood, that is, he took his stand. He's going to make a public announcement to Jesus, but for everybody to hear. Behold, Lord, the half of my goods I give to the poor, and if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I restore it fourfold. Now, at first glance, it doesn't sound like Zacchaeus is going to give any money back. If I have defrauded anybody, well, maybe he's just going to stay crooked. But the Greek language has a first-class condition used here, which gives us clarity. He isn't saying, you know, if I've defrauded anybody, I'm going to go back and I'm going to check it out. And if I have, I'll make restitution. No, this could be rendered, and if I have defrauded anyone of anything, and I certainly have, I did, I restore it fourfold. I see people fainting out on his lawn, just falling over, mouths dropping to the ground. They can't believe what they've just heard. Now, according to the law of Moses, it was only outright premeditated theft that required a fourfold restitution. By the time of Jesus, the Mishnah, the codifying of the law, it had softened it all so that you only had to pay back what you stole. But Zacchaeus is holding himself to the highest standard. He's going all the way back to the original law, and he says, you know, that's what I'm going to do. But he's also in this admitting that he is a premeditating thief. He's telling thousands of people, I'm a crook. I've stolen from you, and I'm not just going to give you back what I stole. I'm going to multiply it by four. Now, because his crimes were financial, one author wrote he had detailed records. He could go check invoices and receipts. He's promising to go through his books. And don't miss this. When Zacchaeus finishes this, he's going to give half of everything he owns away. And then with the remaining half, probably still worth millions, he is going to give to everybody he's cheated times four. Beloved, when he's finished, he may very well have given everything away. Now, he's not doing this so he can be saved. He's doing this to demonstrate that he was. In fact, Jesus makes that clear. Look at verse 9. And Jesus said to him, again, the entire crowd is used as a witness, today, salvation, this is a declaration, has come to this house because he gave his money away. No, that's not what it says. Since he also is a son of Abraham, that is a true son of faith. Abraham was known for faith in God. Romans chapter 4, verse 3 says that Abraham by faith believed God, and God counted his faith to him as righteousness. This is how you get right with God. Not doing everything, but trusting him by faith. And that clears the books between you and God. So Zacchaeus did not become a follower of Christ because he helped the poor or because he became poor or because he even admitted he was a thief. He did all of that because he wanted to demonstrate that he was in fact now as the town's leading crook, no longer, instead, a follower of Christ. If you're a follower of Christ, you don't try to be an honest employee or an honest student or a faithful spouse so that you can go to heaven. You want to live that way because you're going to heaven. And you want to live up to your name and show the world how Jesus has made a difference in your life. I was at Home Depot some time ago, and I went in and asked for some help to load 10 bags of fertilizer onto my truck. A young man in his mid-20s came out to do the heavy lifting, and when we finished, he asked me, have you rung all this stuff up yet? And I said, no, not yet. He said, well, look, I'll go in and tell him you only got 5 bags of fertilizer, and that'll save you $20. If you'll give me $10, you can keep the other 10 and we'll have a sweet deal. I looked around for cameras. This had to be a setup. No. No, I had already noticed that he was wearing a golf shirt with the name of his church written on the front. So instead of saying no thank you and driving away, I decided to hang around a little bit. I said, well, let me get this straight now. You're going to lie and you want me to steal. He paused and looked at me, laughed nervously, wasn't expecting this response, which implied that others had gone along with it before me. And then he kind of said, he laughed and said, well, you know, this stuff's overpriced anyway, and you know, what's the harm? And I pointed and I said, did you forget what shirt you put on this morning? I'm a pastor. And I know your pastor. You want me to call him? And he hung his head and he said, God's after me. I said, I think he is. I represent him. He opened up, admitted that he had strayed from the Lord and had that guilty conscience, been troubled, and he knew it. And we just had a little revival service out there in the parking lot of Home Depot. And I thought about him when I read this text, that God actually chased him up a tree and confronted him. And he responded sincerely. It strikes me that for Zacchaeus, he will begin on this day living up to his name for the first time. Innocent. Pure. Jesus came along and rescued his ruined life.
That was Stephen Davey and a lesson called Snapshots of Ruin and Rescue. In addition to being the president of Wisdom International, Stephen is also the president of Shepherd's Theological Seminary. Stephen has a passion for training and equipping young men for pastoral ministry. That's why he founded and leads that school. Graduates of Shepherd's Seminary are serving the Lord all over the world. Learn more at wisdomonline.org/STS. On our next broadcast, Stephen will bring you the conclusion to this current series, so join us here on Wisdom for the Heart.